matter of which to introduce Mark Pitty. Many of you will be familiar with his presence on the ABC's Inventors, but it's Mark Pitty's perspective on our digital futures that has attracted us to the possibility of Mark as a speaker and an educator, and someone who can actually help us draw together the challenges that are ahead of us. Join the dots, if you like, on those possibilities that lay ahead of all librarians. And I was just reminded this morning when three of us went to the American Library Association conference last year in Washington, the headlines of the Washington Post said, shh, there's 23,000 librarians in Washington. This morning I looked at the Herald and it said, turn that thing off. And I thought, it's a little bit different here. We certainly have some challenges ahead of us. So I'm hoping Mark can steer us in some suggestions, challenge us as librarians for what kind of future we're going to have. And I thought also the fact that Mark has written 5 books, and that can't be a bad thing to be in a room full of librarians having 5 books to your credit. So we have an educator, an author, an inventor with a track record, an academic, someone who's fairly hyper-connected in themselves, in their own right, to talk to us this morning. So please welcome Mark Pitty.
Thank you. That was an awesome introduction. Let's go back to the first slide here. There we go. Okay. Wonderful. So, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak with you. I get to speak to librarians about once every 18 months, and whenever I do, I have to think very, very hard about some things that I don't normally think about at all. I'm a reader, I've always been a reader, I'm a writer, but I don't normally think much in those terms. And yet, when I'm talking about librarians or to librarians, I have to think very much around the terms of literature and learning, beyond the terms I would normally think about as a technologist. And I have one message this morning. Yeah? What can we do about this? Nothing? All right. I've got a good voice. All right. So I'm going to sum it up. I'm going to give you my end point at the beginning, and then we're going to work backward. Here's what I have to say to you. You are all very important. You are, in fact, some of the key actors on the stage in Australia right now. But it may not be for the reasons that anyone thinks. Some of you may have a clue, but perhaps the broader public doesn't. You see, when people hear the word library, they immediately think books. And that's becoming problematic because books are going away. Now, I gave a talk at the National Library last April called Whatever Happened to the Book. And we were just at the beginning of seeing the introduction of electronic books in a widespread format. And I made a prediction as a futurist. I made a prediction. I said, the transition will take the better part of a decade. Now I'm going to talk about my own behavior. Earlier this year, because I couldn't find a copy anywhere, I had to buy a copy of the Game of Thrones book on my Kindle. I then went and tried to buy a copy at an airport bookstore and found that the font size was 10 point and my 49-year-old eyes could not read it. And so I went and bought that on my Kindle and I proceeded to read a 5,000-page book on my Kindle over a period of 5 months. And this is actually the set of books that I've read on my Kindle since about February this year. And I hadn't planned on abandoning books. I absolutely love books. I enjoy books. I have a wall full of books. I like the fact that my friends can come over and see what I'm reading. But I forgot to fight because I could get a new book on the day it was released. and I wouldn't have to leave the comfort of my home. And I forgot the fight when I opened an app on my phone and found that I could continue reading in the same place that I'd left at my bedside the night before. Now, this is a book that was published last month by Werner Vinge. He's a science fiction author, quite well known. He also happens to be a friend of mine. And I bought the book the day it came out, and I'm looking at the front cover going, you know, normally he signs my books for me. So what did I do? I took a screenshot of it and mailed it to him and said, would you mind? And so he signed it. He's like, you want me to sign? He says, yeah, open up Photoshop, sign it. So he signed it and sent it back. So some things can stay the same. Now, I expected that I was going to be immune from all of these charms that we associate with electronic books. I was not, and it seems no one else is immune either. I don't think anyone hates paper. I don't think anyone is particularly charmed by an electronic book. But this transition that we all thought was going to have a lot of friction associated with it, that was probably going to take some time, it seems to be happening very smoothly. It seems to be very easy, and for that reason, it's quick. And so, books are going away as we've known them. And the danger is that in the common mind, the fate of the library is so closely associated with the existence of the book as a physical object that the end of one will immediately presume the death of the other. Now, of course, that would be one of the most culturally short-sighted acts that we could make. Book isn't dying. The book is transforming. It's no longer going to reside somewhere. It's going to live everywhere. And now, what happens to you? I want to start off with a bit of a meta comment. Today, you're getting what I call a black book talk. Normally, when I write talks, and I do a lot of talks, I actually sit at this computer right here, and I type them out laboriously, line after line, paragraph after paragraph. I go through them, I print them, I copy edit them, I practice them. And then, generally, while I'm delivering the talk, I'll actually have my blogging software post it to my blog so that it's, as the talk is finished, it's up on the blog. All very proper. It's all very efficient. But there are other times, and this is one of them. There are times when I want to be close to the words. It's when I want to feel them flow from my pen. And so when that happens, I put it into one of the set of growing Moleskine notebooks. Everything about a black book talk for me is more important because it's more improvisational. It's not really rehearsed. It's more immediate. It's more about connecting with you than presenting to you. It's more about authenticity than a floor show. It's more about being than doing. And of course, the trouble with this format is that it's performative, and if you're not here for it, and I know they're making a recording and I'm making a recording and people will be able to play the recording, but really, unless you were in the room at the time and got the full sense of what's going on, you missed it because it can't be captured. And a web server can't publish it. And it's funny because I mentioned to a friend who is a librarian that I was going to write this talk and that it was going to be a black book talk. And I explained that I had this growing series of Moleskine black books. And he immediately suggested that I donate them to his library. I was chuffed, and I will have to look into this. But it brought home one of the points that I wanted to talk to you about today. Because these black books are simultaneously more concrete and more ephemeral than any of the work that I publish electronically. And that's true because drives crash, because servers blow up, and because networks go down. And to counter this, with all of our electronic trivia, we make backup after backup after backup after backup and so on and so forth. And then we start to encounter another problem, which is really the essence of what I want to talk about. Where is all the stuff? With the black book, I can tell you where all the stuff is. It's all right here. It's all in these pages. So when I was writing this talk, I decided I was going to run a little test because I knew I was going to scare myself a little bit. And so I popped open the search function on my computer and I asked it to locate all of the JPEG files, the image files, on my computer because I wanted to know how many of them there were. It took a little while and it came back with a number. I essentially have 10,000 images on my computer. What are they? I don't know. I know that there are 1,000 of them. That was a box of photos that I had scanned last year. I know that, but I don't know what the other 8,000 are. And why don't I know what these photos are? Well, they just sort of accreted over the digital era. JPEGs have been around and we've been using them more or less since the emergence of the web 15, 16-ish years ago. So that's probably that period of time. And now I've got this assortment, and the assortment, of course, is growing. And I am no different in this than any other of the 22.5 million Australians. We all have digital cameras now, or we have a really, really nice digital camera built into our mobile. And we're constantly taking photos. We're taking photos of what? Of friends, family, kids, events. And what happens to those photos? Where do they go? Where do they live? What are we doing with them? That story was brought home to me when I went back to Boston for my auntie's 60th birthday in June. And it was a lovely party. It was a family event, so it was all of my aunts and uncles and my cousins and then my aunts and uncles' cousins, who I very rarely see, generally only at big family weddings. And one of my aunt's cousins brought something along, and she put it on the table and she opened it up. And it was a wall of photos. And the newest of these photos was taken when my father, who's now 71, was about 10 years old. So the newest of these photos is 60 years old. And these are people that I'd never seen before, such as my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother, and the day that my great-aunt married my great-uncle. And it was a wall of photos. And the entire family, it just became a focal point for the room. And people would come and go and come and go. And, oh, do you remember this? And, oh, do you remember this? And I'm just sitting there taking in the stories of people who are long gone, stories of things that I never knew of. And I wonder now if my nephew turned 10 years old on Thursday. He lives in San Diego, and I was there when he blew the candles out on his cake because his mom took her iPad and Skyped me in, dropped the iPad on the table. We sang happy birthday. They blew the candles out. Now, he's going to be 70 years old in 60 years' time, 2170 more or less. Will he have anything like that wall to show off at his birthday party? Now, yes, you can upload photos to Facebook. You can upload photos to Flickr. Do you really think either of those services are going to be around in 50 years? Do you honestly think we can trust that? This is not a task that can be outsourced. This is not a task that you can really trust a commercial entity with in perpetuity. And the reason is actually in large part because we don't actually understand what this task is. I want you to consider. Another experiment I did for this talk was I went around and I counted up the storage on the computers at home. Now, I will be a bit of an outlier on this, there's no question, but just remember that where I am, everyone else is about to be. I counted up all the storage, and I came trillion characters of information, 13 terabytes. And that's a lot of stuff. That's photos, that's video, that's audio, and who knows what else. And that's the problem. All of our devices are now becoming digital junk drawers. And no piece of software is going to save us from that because this is not a software problem. This is a human problem. We don't have any idea how to manage all of the information that we are so intent on creating every moment of the day. Here, let's get another group shot. So it just piles up. It just gets ignored. It's just forgotten. It's left behind until eventually, because it's lost any connection to anything meaningful, it gets deleted or ends up on something that dies and gets deleted that way. Because no one knows what it's for anymore. And if we are not very careful, this early part of the 21st century is going to have the same quality associated with it that we would normally associate with 7th century Western Europe, the height of the Dark Ages. Now, in that case, librarians saved civilization. That's what it says here. In the Irish monasteries, they kept the thread of continuity going in the West. But of course, there are no Vikings now. There are no rampaging hordes. The greater darkness that's going to come upon us isn't going to come upon us because of attacks. It's going to come upon us because of forgetfulness. Unless another generation of librarians can figure out a way to keep the threads of history from unwinding, from disintegrating. It's your job. You folks are the masters of knowledge management. And you've been doing that since Alexandria. And now what's happened is that every individual in the world has become their own library of Alexandria. Okay. So we're growing accustomed to living in a time of continuous information overload. So that for the first time in human history, it is possible for absolutely everyone to know too much. And This presents its own set of problems because it means that what we need to know is becoming more difficult to discriminate from what we just want to know or what just happens to be around to know. And so it is possible for us to now drown in information which has no utility for us. And in fact, this is a common condition in 2011, that our heads are filled up with so much other stuff that we can't actually make sensible decisions about the things we need to. It's as though we're being fattened up on a diet that substantially lacks nutrition. And the candy that entertains us doesn't enlighten us. It doesn't leave us with the one essential virtue of knowledge, which is the ability to make better decisions. We need to be able to discern, and discernment comes from knowledge and understanding. In order to understand what is useful and what is useless, in order to get there, we have to learn. But we need to learn how to learn, not just learn, we need to learn how to learn. And of course, learning how to learn is, in a sense, the highest of all tasks. That is meant to be the reason we spend so many years in school. Because there's a lot for us to learn before we can get to the point where we can learn how to learn. And, well, once we've gotten there, well, once we've got the degree and they throw us out of uni, we spend the rest of our lives. And this is sort of where things trail off, because we spend the rest of our lives doing what? When someone graduated from university 50 years ago, they pretty much thought that was going to be the end of the matter. And I graduated from university, which I actually didn't, but 30 years ago when I left university, let's put it that way, that's what a computer looked like. And I learned an awful lot about how that kind of computer worked and how that make that computer do all sorts of different things. And almost all of that information, almost all of that knowledge is completely useless to me now. Almost everything has changed. And so the skill set that I entered the workforce with in 1981, suitable for that device, is completely inappropriate for the world of 2011. Now, I'm a learner, and so that means that I sit down and I study and I teach myself everything that I need to learn. All the things that I didn't get taught when I was in university. And of course, every single one of you have done exactly the same thing. We're moving now to the place where everything is now a moving target. And these targets are only accessible via learning. And so we're in a delicate place where the entire culture, everyone, no matter their position, is coming to understand that for some time we've been running to stay in place. And all of the institutions that we form, whether they're government or healthcare or education, all of those institutions are also now in the same boat. They're all now running to keep up. Everyone is running to keep up. Everyone is running to learn, to maintain their knowledge, to keep their place. And is this just going to stay like this? Is this going to continue to be ad hoc? Is it just going to continue to be me sitting and educating myself and you sitting and educating yourselves? Some doing it better than others. But all of it happening essentially without any rhyme or reason. And I'm going to give you now a very real example that's happening everywhere in Australia. This is an Australian classroom. Every Australian classroom is an island unto itself. The teacher wants to learn. The teacher learns. The teacher shares what they learn with their students. There are textbooks, there are resources that are in common. But everything that frames those materials, the teaching style, the narrative, everything that ties it together is essentially completely individual. It is a one-off created by one teacher. And this is essentially the outgrowth of the idea of the one-room schoolhouse brought into the modern day, where the only material the teacher had back then was probably a spelling primer. And of course, we have Google and we have Khan Academy now. But it's still fundamentally one teacher working their way constantly to stay ahead of their students. And that's about to change, because for the first time in the history of the country, all teachers and all students are going to be working from a national curriculum. So that means that in all grades between 3 and 10, the precise details of what are being covered in each grade are going to be well described. And this now implies that no teacher anywhere in Australia is actually alone in any task. No matter what they're doing, there are a few thousand other teachers and tens of thousands of other students who are also doing the same thing. Perhaps not at the same time, but that doesn't matter as much. And perhaps the teachers aren't all doing the same thing in the same way. Perhaps they're not doing it with the same resources. That's the beauty of this, because what you have is essentially something that's similar to the parable of the elephants and the blind men. As each teacher is working their way through their own understanding of the national curriculum, every one of them is developing something unique, reflecting their own approach and their own learning and their own understanding. Of course, the problem right now is that all of that learning and understanding remains individual. Every teacher is rolling a stone up exactly the same hill. But why? Why wouldn't we ask the teachers to all work together at this task? Why wouldn't we invite it? In fact, why wouldn't we make it easy for them to do this? Since we know what kind of resources they will need and when they will need it, isn't the national curriculum simply a giant list of calls to action for resources that the teachers and students will need? Isn't it basically a shopping list? And since every teacher in the nation is both time and resource poor, we can't expect them to do it for themselves, except in the tight little band of their own classroom. Instead, if we expect to be able to gather all of the learning resources that teachers and students will need, that's going to have to come from a group of people who understand how to draw those resources together and understand the taxonomy of the national curriculum. And now I'm going to change the subject completely. I want you all to join me in a thought experiment. Let us say, at this moment, you are being abducted by an alien. You're sitting in the audience, there's a flash of light, there's a bit of a gap in time, and suddenly you are somewhere else. The aliens don't seem to be very evil, although you can't really understand what they're saying. And it seems clear that they actually don't know what they want to do with you, which is good. You're not going to get probed. That's not on the cards. But you're starting to think that maybe this was a mistake. But you can't understand anything. So you don't really know what they're looking for, and you don't really know how to give it to them. And so you just sort of watch the aliens talking amongst themselves, and sort of see something in the hand gestures. They've got hands. And eventually, they seem to reach some sort of consensus, and you're hoping against hope that they've decided that perhaps this was a mistake, and they'll be returning you home. And just as they pop you into the transport beam, one of the aliens thinks for a second and shoves something into your hands, and then there's another flash of light, and bam, you're back home, only it doesn't look anything like home. It looks really, really alien. You're thinking that these aliens are so stupid they can't do anything right. They can't even get you back to Earth. Okay. You're stuck. Here. Wherever here is. And so what are you going to do? Well, the first thing you've realized is that the air is breathable, because if it weren't, you'd be dead already. Good. It's a great place to start. What are you going to drink when you get thirsty? What are you going to eat when you get hungry? Is it going to get cold? Is it going to rain or snow? Are you going to need to seek shelter? And you're just sort of filled up with these questions, wondering what your fate is going to be, when you realize that the alien popped a gadget into your hands. And you can imagine, since this story has a happy ending, how the rest of the story goes, which is that the gadget has just enough information, even though it's all in a weird alien script, for you to be able to figure out where something is that you can drink and something that you can eat, and perhaps even a bit of a weather forecast. And eventually you might even figure out how to use it to phone home. Of course, the aliens are going to have to give you a lift, but you might be able to work that out too. Now, when I dreamed up this thought experiment, I did that for a talk that I gave earlier this year. I thought it was really going to remain in the realm of the theoretical. I thought it was useful for thinking, but I didn't really think about making it real. As I was working on this talk, I got a great idea. Next year sometime, what I want to do is I want to put myself on a flight to Shanghai. And I don't want to bring anything but my passport and a credit card. And my phone. And I want to find out how far I can go with just those resources, given that I can neither read nor speak the language, and that I've done no advanced planning. All right? I'm popped down in an alien land. Could I make my way on my own? How far would I be able to go before I'd have to stop someone and say, excuse me, could you help me, whatever? How far could I go with just a gadget in my hand if that gadget is networked, connected globally, has things downloaded on it? What are the kinds of resources that I could bring to bear to solve all of the challenges posed by what I can only call extreme tourism? Because the better equipped I am with resources, the better I will be able to take advantage of any situation that I find myself in. The more I know, the more successful I'll be. And that's true in Shanghai, that's true on an alien world, that's true here in Sydney. Now, two things are going on right now in the culture. Things are changing very rapidly. And alongside of that, there's another truth. None of us are making very good use of all of the knowledge resources that we have surrounding us now. We go around most of the time believing that we have to survive on what we've absorbed in our heads at any given moment in time. That's pretty much what we've got. We're slowly learning that we have access to an incredible wealth of resources in our pockets, at our fingertips, and those resources extend our capabilities dramatically. If only we know how to use them. If only someone could teach us how to put those resources to work. So I've spent the last 33 minutes drawing a line around three different domains. One, the avalanche of information that accompanies the digital self, the fact that we are now all our own libraries of Alexandria. Two, the evident need for a framework for sharing resources that's driven by the needs of the national curriculum. And three, just now, the gap between our resource potential and our actual capabilities. All three of these rely on the proper application of a key to unlock that potential. And you are that key. Libraries were never about books or collections. To believe that is to confuse the menu with the meal. Libraries and librarians have always been about knowledge management. Ever since Alexandria, librarians have dealt with information overload. It's your raison d'être. It's what you do. And although it's taken 2,000 years, the rest of us have finally caught up. And now that we've caught up, if you listen close, you can hear something. And you hear it from every corner of culture. You hear the sound of a civilization that's being drowned by its own capability to generate new information. And these are not the sorts of problems that we can compute our way out of. These are human problems. They involve working with meaning and with significance and with narrative. There is no robot librarian that will be able to come and help us. It's all you. It's just you. And so, without a trace of hyperbole, or should I say hyperbole, I will assert that librarians are among the most important actors in 21st century civilization. Because without your help, it all starts to unwind. First, it becomes a rat's nest of complexity, and then it just fades away. So I have three recommendations. Libraries in the 21st century must be the place that people can turn to deal with their mess, to clean their digital closets, to tame their chaos. You have to build programs around this. And you have to do this in a way that actually builds skills within the communities that you service so that you are not doing this consistently. You're training the people in the community who will then train the other people in the community and so on. So you're the point of ignition for a broader sense of how to do this. And of course, because we're all running to stay in a place, that training continues. But it won't be your job to train every single individual in the community. You work with the leaders. The leaders will work with the troops. And you've got to do this now. And of course, you're all nibbling at it. We're all nibbling at it. But we have to now think of this formally, because the amount of data that we have is going up so quickly, and the need to be able to keep track of it is growing so prominent that this is now becoming something that is going to be foregrounded rather than backgrounded. This is not just we're losing the past. This is we are losing the past. Point two. Every librarian in Australia should grab a copy of the national curriculum and go through it and observe it as if it were a shopping list for resources. And then, across the entirety of the nation, across all of your libraries, start to collaborate and share and build the resources in common. Teachers and students and parents will thank you because they will know where to go for their resources. Google is not going to be able to answer this question. You will be able to answer this question. This is a process that continues year after year, not just because the curriculum changes, but because the resources available change. And it becomes a process where resources found in one year can be fed into the next year, and so on and so on and so on. So it becomes a living contribution of the library to Australia's education. Point three. We're now poised at the cusp of a revolution in resources. Australians proportionately own more smartphones than any other people on the planet. Over 50% of us now own smartphones. 2 years' time, it'll be 85% of us. And as the NBN is deployed across the nation, distance is going to collapse. And so Broome and Albany and Geelong and Townsville will all be close to the center. And they'll be as close to the center in that sense as Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane. And so there's the potential here for a huge power shift, a huge reconfiguration of the downhill slide that has brought Australians into the cities because the cities represent the most connected places. And connectivity means opportunity and commerce. Well, now that opportunity is going to be distributed across the nation because of the NBN and because of the smartphones. And so now that every one of us is going to be well connected to all the resources that we can need to find our way in the world, well, now that we have the capability for those resources to be delivered, do we have those resources in place? I've been having a series of discussions with the State Library of Victoria around what kind of frameworks libraries need to put in place to deal with the NBN, because it's not just giving you Google faster. If we're using the NBN for that, we've missed the point. It's about using it as a tool to improve your capabilities. Well, you tell most people that, they'll go, well, what do you mean? How can I use this as a tool to improve my capabilities? Well, that's what you have to teach them. That's what we all need to learn. And you are the resource masters. So this is a moment of mastery where you, the experts, get to share your expertise with the rest of the nation. Because a librarian glories in their mastery of information. You know where to look for things. And if you don't, you know where to look for an answer to where to look. And so you are the key to making us smarter and more effective, not just in years 3 to 10, but as a nation from age 2 to age 82. You're the key to turning the lucky country into a smart nation. You're the center. You're the center of the future. Because in a world where what you know is what you can do, all roads lead to the library, which isn't a building. It's a network of experts, and I'm looking out on that network of experts. It's a network of experts helping Australians manage knowledge. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.